Hi, everybody, and welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And by the way, if you're joining us now, you can visit Alan Smithy Podcast at alansmithypodcast.com. We finally registered the domain name, so you don't have to type in the WordPress thing anymore. Of course, if you're a regular listener, you know, as soon as you hit A, the rest of it will auto-fill into your browser by now. But now you can just have it autofill to alansmithypodcast.com instead of .wordpress.com. So that's exciting. Anyways, in this episode, we're going to be talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which should need no introduction, but we'll introduce it in a second, and the rather blatant Roger Rabbit cash-in, which came out 4 years afterwards, Cool World. I think we've got a lot to say about both of them, but as is usually the tradition, we'll talk about the good movie and the one that came out first, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So I say it doesn't need an introduction, but as you pointed out to me when we were talking about doing this one, this was sort of one of those movies where when it came out, and then for a long time afterwards, it was kind of the biggest thing ever. Like, it was the movie that everybody was talking about. I think the Roger Ebert review, because I'm getting him into this episode early. The first few sentences are like, everybody I know is telling me I have to see this movie, and you can't buy that kind of word of mouth, which, you know, is true, and, you know, which is deserved because it's a great movie. But yeah, why did you, like, I think I kind of know what you mean, I know what you mean, but I don't know how it is that it came to be that somehow the reputation of Roger Rabbit waned. Like, how did that happen?
Okay, so it was really big in 88 through, we want to say, like, 94, 95-ish. What's the timeline on the short movies?
There were Roger Rabbit shorts, two or three of them produced, you know, to go in front of other Disney movies, just like old cartoons used to come on before the movies did. But I think the last of those was probably like 1994 or something. I think there was one. The first one came before Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which was just a year after Roger Rabbit. And then the other one was for like, it wasn't for Thumbelina.
No, it was for Dick Tracy was the second one.
Oh,
the third one was A Far Off Place, which, you know, nobody in the world has ever seen. Yeah.
Holy mackerel. I just remembered something. I actually, when I was a little kid, went to see that movie because I knew it had the Roger Rabbit short. I haven't remembered this for years. And then I couldn't stay through A Far Off Place because it's like not a kid's movie. It's like a kid's melodrama, and what kid wants to sit through one of those? But yeah, okay. So when was A Far Off Place?
That was 93. And
all right,
some of this had the problem of it had to have some involvement. Well, Steven Spielberg was involved in all this. In fact, we'll probably talk about him a little bit more later. But the shorts had to come before Steven Spielberg involved movies, preferably. It looks like Michael Eisner bumped the second one to Dick Tracy, even though it was supposed to be on Arachnophobia. And what's funny about that is I saw Dick Tracy in the theater, and I don't really remember there being a short on it, but I'm not sure. It could have been there. I don't know. I might have also gotten to Dick Tracy late because I believe that was the first day I ever saw two movies in the first day. I saw Dick Tracy in the theater and Die Hard 2. And it was the same theater.
1990. Good summer.
And so I think that it just, well,
you know, there's kind of, I mean, this movie wasn't, let's, can we just cut to the chase and blame it on the internet killing people's memory?
Okay, there you go.
All right, yeah, the internet has killed people. That's why Tim Burton's Batman is suddenly a piece of shit through revisionist internet fanboyism. But I think also part of people forgetting about Roger Rabbit is that there was basically a resurgence. The animation industry revived thanks to two things. This movie and a TV series which came out the year before called The New Adventures of Mighty Mouse, which was a revival of Mighty Mouse, obviously, but it was produced by Ralph Bakshi, who directed Cool World, and which we'll probably have to jump back and forth between the two movies a little bit, but we'll try to keep that to a minimum. But these two things kind of revived an interest in animation after basically two or three decades of animation being just the lowest rung on the Hollywood ladder. I mean, if you've ever seen any Saturday morning cartoon from the 70s or 80s, first of all, I'd like to say that there are support groups and you should reach out to them. And secondly, if you've ever seen a Saturday morning cartoon from the 70s or 80s, you know that even 5-year-olds had a hard time getting through that crap. And the reason for that was basically that when theatrical cartoons died, when they were killed by television and Saturday morning cartoons became the new normal, there was such a demand on production for them that basically they went to kind of an assembly line system of animation production on very limited budgets. And as that was happening, all the real animators, the Warner Brothers guys, the Disney guys, the MGM guys, they were all kind of old and dying or retiring, and they weren't like training people to be their replacements. So you had a whole bunch of like up and coming cartoonists going into animation who knew what they liked, but they didn't really know, you know, like Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse, but they didn't really know how it was made. Like they weren't there in the studios in the 30s and 40s seeing how they were made. So they kind of like blamed the lower quality of Saturday morning cartoons on the fact that they had a fraction of the money. But that wasn't the real problem. The real problem was the TV industry had to crank all these cartoons out for Saturday mornings so on such a level that they were just like, oh, fuck, we need a bunch of writers because, you know, TV producers don't know about how cartoons were made, you know, by Warner Brothers. They didn't know how Bugs Bunny was made. They assumed cartoons were made by writers. And all the classic cartoons, all the Disney and Warner Brothers, MGM, all that stuff, they weren't made by writers. They were made by people who could draw and who just liked to draw funny pictures. And if they had an idea for a funny gag, they would storyboard it. They didn't have scripts. They worked off of storyboards because it was a visual medium. Arguably, it's even more of a visual medium than filmmaking. So people who could draw were suddenly – all of a sudden they had to animate these scripts written by people who, you know, had seen cartoons but who didn't really like them. They were trying to break into writing sitcoms and they were like, oh, so I'll just start writing cartoons. And so suddenly like Saturday morning cartoons by the 60s, basically by the time of like Scooby-Doo even, which was like late 60s, cartoons were like unwatchable because like they were, the animation was kept to a minimum. The characters like didn't move. They were like, I mean, you watch an episode of Scooby-Doo, it's like mannequins talking to each other for the most part. And that's not even talking about like, you know, 10, 20 years of Hanna-Barbera ripping off its own Scooby-Doo concept over and over. But yeah, these cartoons were not really, they were only technically cartoons. This is a long-winded explanation. I'm trying to keep it real brief, but the point is the industry and the medium were considered not only dead but just like unpleasant. Like cartoon was a dirty word. And the only theatrical cartoons that were coming out were like Disney movies. that were being made after Walt friggin' died in 1967. So they were all just guessing at, you know, how the old man would have done it. And if you look at Disney movies from the 70s or 80s, they're kind of like fully animated, which is to say they have many in-between drawings and lots of movement and stuff, but they're not exactly – I mean they're all just kind of, you know, Disney formula movies. And we all know what the Disney formula is, whether it's princesses or comic relief talking animals or the villains or whatever. Like everything is very formulaic. So it's fully animated formulaic stuff. Okay, so The New Adventures of Mighty Mouse hits in 87, and this is the first TV cartoon to be done by cartoonists because it's made by Ralph Bakshi, who was the first animator who made fully animated movies for adults, most famously Fritz the Cat, which was sold in 1972 as the first X-rated cartoon, which it was. And they made that their selling point. And it's actually like, you know, it's well animated, but I'm not going to talk much about Ralph Bakshi right now until we get to Cool World. But New Adventures like had all this stuff that was basically funny and clever in addition to having funny drawings. It would have like pop culture references, and it would break the third wall, and it would have sarcasm, and it would have actual humor. As compared to, I don't know, the Gary Coleman cartoon or the Smurfs or what have you, or, I don't know, Gem and the Holograms, or pick any cartoon from the 80s or 70s. So I believe it was because of The New Adventures of Mighty Mouse and the buzz around that Robert Zemeckis wanted to make this movie. And they adapted it from a novel called Who Censored Roger Rabbit, which is out of print and really hard to find, and I would love to read it, but it bears only like a slight resemblance to the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Yeah. The main thing that Zemeckis was kind of buying was the idea of let's have humans and cartoons together in a movie, and that had been done before in the movies. Probably the most famous example is actually another Disney movie, Song of the South, which has been banned for years because it has Uncle Remus and it has, you know, black people shucking and jiving, basically, even though it's not really, I would argue, a racist movie, but that's another story. But like it had been done in the movies, and there's some Gene Kelly movie where he dances with, you know, Tom from Tom and Jerry because it's MGM. But like when that would be done, it would only be done for you know, a scene or two at a time. And by the way, Ralph Bakshi also experimented with doing scenes with live action like backgrounds and animated characters on them, or live actors and people talking to each other, but people didn't notice that kind of innovation because, you know, he was the X-rated animator because of Fritz the Cat. Boy, this is a lot of backstory before we can talk about the movie. I apologize again. But yeah, so I mean, but kind of like, you know, the amazing technical achievements of Who Framed Roger Rabbit is that like they put so much effort into the lighting and the animated characters casting shadows and just like the physicality of, you know, when Roger Rabbit is jumping all over Bob Hoskins, that it's really convincing. And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the movie kind of was, you know, maybe it would have been a hit on that alone. But then on top of that, like, it's actually like a really good movie. Just so far as, you know, the whole idea of, okay, let's have it set in the 50s, and let's have it be like some kind of detective story that coincides with the golden age of animation when theatrical cartoons were being made. And it's got good acting, you know, good writing. It's a lot like Back to the Future, actually, even though the two movies kind of on one level have nothing to do with each other. It's just kind of the fact that it's like Robert Zemeckis directing, and there's similarities in the screenplay, actually. I don't know, like when he sees the photo of Marvin Acme's will in his pocket, it's just like Back to the Future 2 where they see the Gray's sports almanac in Biff's pocket in a photo, you know, and they're looking at it in the magnifying lens. Oh, and both movies have friggin' Christopher Lloyd. And also both movies have music by Alan Silvestri, which is probably the biggest thing that reminds me of makes me associate the two. But yeah, you know, I watched it again this week. It lasts. It holds up, which is, you know, probably more than you can say for Space Jam, which seemed to which seemed to be the extent of other ventures into combining cartoons and humans in feature length movies. Well,
Cool World. Not forget that Space Jam sort of killed any theatrical animation from anybody but Disney.
Yeah. I was also going to mention Looney Tunes Back in Action.
Oh, I forgot about that.
It's another. It seems like every subsequent effort after Roger Rabbit to do a Roger Rabbit kind of movie has ended in disaster. That's what I'm saying. But Roger Rabbit does hold up. Fucking great movie.
Yeah, I think that its audience just kind of grew up. Rabbit.
Well, what do you mean? Because, like, actually, I don't think it would have been the massive success that it was if it didn't have the adult critical acclaim going on top
of it. It did, but the adult, I don't think that adults sort of.
Do you think it was based more on nostalgia than anything?
No, I think that an adult of a certain – until a certain point in time would always – you'd always run into somebody like, oh, you got to see The Godfather Part 2. An adult, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that age of adult, those people are now in their mid-40s and up. And until then, it's people telling you to see – if you're lucky, Blade Runner, and if you're not, they're telling you to see Legend, right? Because they have 4 copies of it on DVD. So it is really that the internet has sort of given voice to the lowest common denominator of even fanboyism. But Roger Rabbit wasn't a fanboy thing. I mean, Roger Rabbit was as big of a cultural phenomenon as the first Batman movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which,
yeah.
If you weren't, you know, around for that, you've got to realize that it was incredibly big. Batman was a bigger, I don't know if Batman made more money than Indiana Jones, but Indiana Jones was never a cultural phenomenon like Batman. In fact, I would argue that Star Wars never reached the cultural phenomenon level of that one summer with Batman.
Well, you know, Batman was kind of the culmination of, you know, the previous 50 years of Batman being a beloved American cultural icon, but Roger Rabbit, kind of like Star Wars, was based on things from the pop culture of the past, but kind of reinventing it and creating new characters and mythology out of scratch. And it really did create a mythology, by the way, because to this day, people refer to some cartoon shows or characters as toons. You know, apostrophe T-O-O-N-S until they dropped the apostrophe.
Yeah, it just was incredible, and it just didn't sustain. And I'm trying to remember, you know, I assume that Roger Rabbit lost its support when a certain segment of the audience grew into high school age and they couldn't like a cartoon anymore, and that it never recovered.
Yeah.
It never got rediscovered. For example, the DVD has the three shorts on it.
Yeah.
I was under the impression those had never even been released. Like, I had no idea till I got the Vista series DVD here from the library. And the problem is that the Vista series DVD, it's, the Vista series from Disney is their elite line. You know, every M. Night Shyamalan movie ever wanted to see, you could get in Vista series. But it's still presented as more to kids in a way. Just the packaging of it is, you know, this goofy fake. It's like a Photoshop of Bob Hoskins against the drawing, and then Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at it. I'm looking at that too on the IMDb page. But, yeah, the DVD is for kids. In fact, it even has, if I remember correctly, two different versions. Mm-hmm. No, not two different versions of the movie. Two different versions of the extras. There's like the extras for kids or for the whole family, and then there's the extras for like grown-up movie fans who actually care about the process.
They call it family friendly and enthusiast, and the family friendly disc includes the full screen copy of the movie.
That's hilarious, because this movie was shot in like 188. The fucking black bars do not edge down that far into your TV set, you yokels.
And let's not forget that it also, we're in HD land, so for them to perpetuate this just a few years ago,
it's irresponsible.
Yeah, so I think that, yeah, and now at this point,
it's interesting about the age gap that you mentioned, like people who enjoyed this get to high school age, because like a lot of stuff happened real rapidly after this movie for animation. Basically, Steven Spielberg was so I'm presuming here, but I think Steven Spielberg was so jealous of not being involved with Roger Rabbit that then not only did he decide that he was going to produce some Roger Rabbit shorts to go in front of other Spielberg produced movies over the next few years, but he decided he, of all people, was the most uniquely qualified to reintroduce the Looney Tunes for a new generation with Tiny Toon Adventures.
That's true, yeah.
Which, you know, is the brilliant, totally thinking outside the box idea of taking old characters and making them kids who go to school, you know, to relate to the kids who will be watching the cartoon. But the funny thing was, you know, he's Steven Spielberg, he's richer than God, so he, you know, not only did the series have, you know, big budgets, but he actually hired people off of the New Adventures of Mighty Mouse to work on it, who then shortly thereafter they actually left Tiny Toons to create Ren and Stimpy, which then changed the animation business all over again, even more so than Roger Rabbit, because even more so than Roger Rabbit, this was a cartoon that could actually be watched by adults on prime time. And also coinciding with this, you have The Simpsons, whose influence has been well documented. But basically, like between The Simpsons and Ren and Stimpy, you got adults to watch cartoons again and the medium to kind of be respected again by the industry, or, you know, by Hollywood at large. So, yeah, the movie, it's funny. I guess the influence of Roger Rabbit extends further than people's memory of it. But, you know, I think it's a better movie than Tiny Toon Adventures ever was a cartoon show, or Animaniacs, which was like Tiny Toon's version 2.0, also produced by Spielberg afterwards.
Yeah, I haven't seen Roger Rabbit in
'Simultaneous to all this, I think it was the same. No, it was a year after Roger Rabbit, The Little Mermaid came out.
Yeah, and saved Disney's butt.
Which was the beginning of Disney, making popular animated movies again.
For 6 years or something really long for them before they bombed out, before
Toy Story saved them. Basically, like Roger Rabbit was like at the cusp of all this stuff, all this renewed interest in animation that basically, it kind of lasted. I mean, it went so strong, but in retrospect, I think it was all kind of fizzled out and done with by the end of the 90s. And then Family Guy really put the nail in the coffin, and Adult Swim. But, you know, where you have like cartoons that, again, have the minimum of animation, but now they're for adults because they have rude humor. Oh, and South Park also killed it again.
Which doesn't even have animation.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, it's been forever since I've seen it. And I still have the same problem that I had as a kid.
All right, yeah, why don't let's criticize it.
Bob Hoskins sucks.
Bob, I'm going to kill you. Bob, though.
I'm watching this movie, and I'm saying to myself, so they're doing this really cool Chinatown thing, and they're doing, you know, an homage to old Humphrey Bogart, Robert Mitchum movies, and then they have Bob Hoskins, who they casted on the Danny DeVito ticket, that, oh, he's little and ugly, so it'll be funny. And
do you really think that they were going for that? Because I feel like the movie doesn't exploit his short height, except for the scene where he's standing neck to neck with Jessica Rabbit and her
kids. But
that
scene starts with him being in boxer shorts and a tie, and it's
right.
The most hideous thing in the world.
Yeah,
and I'm sure that Danny DeVito never did that because he didn't want people to mock him. Like, he didn't want to be like, you know, he let them mock him for other things, but he didn't, like, go that extra mile. But Hoskins was willing to do it. And I'm sure Hoskins got the job because, you know, Zemeckis and Spielberg were like, wow, he was really great and whatever in the UK. And they're like, let's have him come over and do this. I will say that Hoskins is able to do the physical acting with the animation. But no, you don't believe Joanna Cassidy would ever. I mean, the other problem is that his character's backstory is contrived.
Yeah.
Just to move it along and take a lot of shortcuts. And so whenever you concentrate on that, it's a problem. And Zemeckis does a beautiful job recreating L.A. That's like why the Chinatown feeling is there, is because there's such a beautiful recreation of old L.A. But actually, I think the story is like the Two Jakes, right?
I've never seen the Two Jakes.
I'm pretty sure, yeah, it is actually the Two Jakes. Is actually where the...
Well, that's funny because it actually precedes the Two Jakes.
Yeah, but I think isn't the Two Jakes based on a novel? Anyway, but yeah. No, it's like the Two Jakes very well could be based on Roger Rabbit because it's about Nicholson getting in trouble after he's on a marriage case and something like that. And it's like exactly that. But that, and I have like some problems. I think the editing's weak, but I mean, that wasn't my traditional problem. As a kid, the reason I stopped watching Roger Rabbit is because by the time I was 15, I was like, I can't cope with Bob Hoskins.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
See, I mean, okay, well, okay. I was a kid too, and I was pretty uncritical towards any aspect of this movie. I don't think I could have come up with a single thing I didn't like about it, but I always remember Bob Hoskins fondly in this because I didn't know who Bob Hoskins was. And then like, it was such a shock to find out that he was a British guy that I was like, wow, that was an American accent he was doing? No way. And I just had all this respect for him for doing a convincing American accent, you know?
And he is
his character's backstory is very convoluted, and to a large degree he is just kind of a cipher. Not as much of a cipher as Gabriel Byrne, because nobody could be more of a cipher than Gabriel Byrne in Cool World. But
don't jump ahead.
I'm not.
Okay.
But that's why I always fondly remember Bob Hoskins, because he was like one of the first actors I became aware of as a kid because of finding out that he wasn't American and because he was because he was acting opposite cartoon characters. That helped also. But I think – I don't know. I mean, there's nothing – would you say there's anything wrong with his acting? Because I'll agree with you that his character is kind of weak, but I think he sells it.
No, I think that – No, I don't think that he sells it. I think that he's never it occurred to me in the last scene when – oh, so, you know, they save the day anyway. he's gonna he's like, they're scared he's gonna abuse
Roger. Yeah.
And I'm like, there's nothing in this character that I've seen in this movie that suggests to me he's gonna do that. When he's being rough with the rabbit earlier and stuff, it's because he knows he can be, because it's cartoon. And so he's a lot, he's able to do this kind of thing to Toons. He doesn't give any impression of being dangerous at any time or anything else. Because I was watching it and I was kind of like,
it is, yeah.
Who else? I mean, to some degree,
it is. Well, to some degree, I mean, it is a Disney kids movie where the only person who's really supposed to be scary is Christopher Lloyd.
But it's not. I mean, that's like the thing is it's not really a kids movie.
Like, let's get into this now, because, you know, Disney didn't want its name on it because they thought it was too risque with certain things. And, you know, let's see what's the rating? PG? PG-13?
It's just PG.
It's just PG. And, you know, it's kind of like the story, all the detective stuff is for – all the detective stuff is for the grown-ups, but it's never explicit or particularly dirty. But I think, like, for kids, it walks that fine line of seeming like, ooh, this is a story, you know, for grown-ups, but there's nothing scary in it, you know, that's going to keep me from enjoying the cartoon part. And actually, as a kid, you mentioned, like, you never think he was very threatening. I can tell you the scene where I believed that he had an edge to him. It's the scene where he kicks that guy's stool out under him at the bar and shoves an egg in his mouth, which, you know, is like Three Stooges stuff. But if you're a kid,
yeah,
it'll kind of make you believe that this guy's got an edge to him.
Yeah, maybe as a kid it did, but this time I was just like,
all right, well, okay, but then that's going back to what you're saying. Yeah, people growing out of it.
I mean, I think that part of the reason, and I haven't actually seen Hoskins's gangster movies, so maybe he can sell being a violent little troll.
You should see The Long Good Friday. That's a great
movie. Yeah, but I just, in this particular instance, he just doesn't sell it to me, and I think that it's strong the rest of the movie is that he doesn't have, even though he's in the movie more than anybody else,
yeah,
that he's able to sell it. The movie's able to sell it.
Yeah. Well, you know, so obviously, you know, Disney didn't make this a touchstone movie because of the violence. I think the real reason they did it is because of Jessica Rabbit, who was as much a part of the cultural impact
exactly.
at time of yeah. the movie as anything else. And you know what? Looking back, it's actually kind of hilarious because there's really something hideous about Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah, she's very funny looking. Like, it's like she doesn't have two eyes and stuff. Yeah, it's creepy.
Yeah, she's like a Frankenstein monster of, like, elements that, you know, a real person, but on a cartoon sexy girl, those separate elements might work, but she really is like a Frankenstein stitched together kind of monstrosity. She looks worse in animation than like a Barbie doll would if you suddenly put those proportions into real life. But yeah, it's like, you know, the nightclub scene and then the fact that the first act is about, you know, her having an affair with someone other than Roger Rabbit, you know, and then that supposedly drives him to jealousy and, you know, commits a murder, which he didn't really, and who framed him anyway? Oh, gee, could it be Christopher Lloyd? Could it? Do you think the guy who framed Roger Rabbit could be the guy whose name is Judge Doom, who wears all black and who has like who has like some kind of menacing wind blowing his trench coat in every scene.
You can't get on that because in Green Lantern, which I have read from multiple grown men, is a great film. The bad guy's, the secret bad guy's name is Sinestro. So, I mean, it's grown up.
Yeah,
I think that, well, there aren't any suspects. That's like the greatest thing about Roger Rabbit is.
Maybe that's why they didn't put a question mark in the title.
Yeah, there's no question mark. There aren't really any suspects. As soon as the cast establishes itself, it's not a very big cast. And it's sort of propelled along by cartoon cameos. Like Benny the Cab, like I remember him having a huge role. He really does not have a very big role. Maybe he has a big role in my mind because I remembered playing the Nintendo game or whatever where you drive him around. Once the human actors are established, it's a very reductive process after that, as they die off one by one.
Yeah, it's sort of like Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Could it be Judge Doom, R.K. Maroon, or Jessica Rabbit? And then R.K. Maroon is killed off, and then two scenes later, Jessica Rabbit saves Bob Hoskins' life. So that really narrows it down, doesn't it? Yeah. By the way, speaking of the whole murder mystery, and it's kind of a stretch to call it that, but did I miss something, or does the movie kind of contradict itself? Because when Bob Hoskins confronts Maroon, because he finds out Maroon owns a piece of the trolley company that's going to, you know, that Toontown is going to be torn down through, and Toontown is owned by the guy who was murdered, supposedly, by Roger Rabbit. You know, he's like, he's got his gun to him, and R.K. Maroon, the head of the cartoon studio, is pleading, you know, I didn't know he was going to be killed. We were just going to blackmail him with the pictures of him and Jessica Rabbit. And then it's like, you're just going to blackmail him? Well, but the reason that you hired Bob Hoskins in the first place was to get photos to show to Roger Rabbit. So it kind of ruins the point of blackmail if you spill the beans to the person to whom, you know, you could blackmail someone over, right?
Yeah, there's that. And the whole reason that Acme and Maroon – like, does Maroon get killed because he's –
I think
Maroon
he gets killed
because he's talking.
Because he owns Toontown.
No, he didn't own Toontown, right?
Oh,
I don't think he owns.
No, I think he does because there's all this stuff about his will. Because his will.
No, that was Acme. Acme owned Toontown.
Oh, sorry, I thought you meant Acme. Yeah.
No, Maroon gets killed. Maroon has this really. His last line is, "I always love those tunes," so suggesting that he was going to try and get them Toontown, but he's in bed with the Judge Doom's company, and it.
Yeah.
The third act is way too long, because all it is it's Roger and Bob Hoskins and Jessica in trouble, and it's a very long sequence, and it's kind of
like a chase. The whole third act is just a chase scene that goes on forever.
Yeah, after they get to Toontown for a second, it just turns into this one thing, and so this whole Cloverleaf thing, it's only owned by there's a lot of lip service to grounding it in like believable reality for the adults, but you've got to
but it's actually pretty much just a takeoff on Chinatown. It's practically just like the whole thing is just like a reference to Chinatown and, you know, the company wanting to take over the land and whatever. So yeah, I know it doesn't matter. I just had to make sure I didn't completely overlook something because that seems like it makes no sense at all. Anyways, yeah, and other stuff. Well, you know, I don't, like I said, I pretty much love this movie, so I don't really have criticisms of it. Although actually, okay, well, here's a criticism. It was going to be an observation, but I guess it's a criticism. And I don't know if it's time to segue into Cool World yet, but The animation in Roger Rabbit was done by a British fella named Richard Williams. And it's interesting because it's a British guy's it's a British guy's imitation of Warner Brothers and MGM type animation, like Bugs Bunny and Droopy. I mean, Droopy's in it, you know. But it's a Disney movie, and the majority of the characters who cameo are Disney characters, with only a few exceptions, like Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Woody Woodpecker, and Droopy. Oh, and Betty Boop, and that's all basically it. And everybody else is Disney. And it's very fully animated. Like, there's a lot of movement, but in a way, that's kind of what I don't. I like it, and I like it for this movie, for Roger Rabbit, because actually the constant movement helps sell the reality that cartoon characters and people are coexisting. But ordinarily in animation, I don't care for that, because it's just something that you can do if you have enough money. And if you look at most Disney movies, especially like the ones I mentioned, the ones made in between Walt's death and Little Mermaid, not that Little Mermaid is, you know, anything to write home about animation-wise, but it's just kind of like the full movement is like it's a replacement for acting, because it's replacing acting with constant movement. And there's actually, you know, remember when Truman Capote said of Jack Kerouac that that's not writing, that's typing? John Kay, the creator of Ren and Stimpy, who was Ralph Bakshi's protege, and who worked on New Adventures of Mighty Mouse. See how this all interconnects? Animation is a very small field. John Kay actually said of Don Bluth, who was a Disney director on movies like The Rescuers, and then he went on to do his own movies like The Secret of Nim and An American Tale, which was actually produced by Spielberg. John Kay said of Don Bluth's movies, like, basically, it's just a lot of like flailing around and constant movement. And that's not acting. That's full in-betweening. So if you look at the quote unquote acting of the cartoon characters in Roger Rabbit, whether it's the weasels or Roger or Benny the Cab, it's all kind of the same thing. It all seems like it's just the same mode of like constant frantic flailing around and movement. And if you think about, and Roger Rabbit doesn't really have a character beyond being someone who's supposed to be constantly bouncing off the walls. And like, I don't know, Baby Herman, put him in there too. It's just the constant movement. Well, what's my point? It's impressive, and it was probably necessary to sell the illusion, but I wouldn't particularly praise the animation of Roger Rabbit as being anything great. It's the fact that it was combined with the live action that makes it great, but it's not the animation itself. Even though at the time, I mean, this would have been, you know, this would have been light years better to watch than whatever was on Saturday morning. Of course.
Right.
And also it was light years better than even whatever full-length animated movies would have been in the theater at the time, which would have been, you know, An American Tale. Steven Spielberg presents An American Tale. Steven Spielberg thinks he knows a lot about cartoons. Let me tell you something. Steven Spielberg does not know a lot about cartoons. He just has a lot of money. And he also is not a funny guy. He seems to want to be a funny guy, but he is not a funny guy. That's why his great idea for an animated TV show was to reuse the Looney Tunes characters as little kids going to school. That's why his idea for a cartoon show was Looney Tunes babies. So yeah, Steven Spielberg, not a funny guy, and a cartoon fan who doesn't know really about how cartoons are made. And that's kind of the funny thing, and I don't know, if I have one kind of summarizing point about Roger Rabbit, it was as good a movie as could have been made by people who had by like Hollywood people who had nostalgic memories of real cartoons like Roger, like Bugs Bunny and even Mickey Mouse, but who were not animators or cartoonists themselves. And fortunately, it ended up not mattering, but that's why they got a British guy to do the animation in this movie.
Okay. No, yeah, the animation, Roger Rabbit.
I'm trying to have as controversial of opinions as you possibly can about Roger Rabbit here.
Well, I think the problem with the animation too is that the only real animation you see with when they're not having to cope with shading to include Bob Hoskins is the opening cartoon with Baby
yeah,
Herman.
Roger Rabbit, Baby Herman, yeah.
And it's sort of it's a smorgasbord.
It's exactly what I'm talking about. It's just like let's have constant movement and chaos.
You have like
and expensive, hard to draw camera angles and camera movements to hide the fact that this is
yeah.
This is nothing really.
There are occasionally these moments of like sort of just the beautiful quietness that some of the old Disney cartoons had, but then it'll be filled with something from Warner and then like a lot of Tex Avery, which is a good segue. I was shocked how much Tex Avery there is in this movie.
Well, it's like but it's not real Tex Avery.
Well, it's not real Tex Avery, but that's the other problem.
It's
with
the Disney version.
That's
of Tex
the other
Avery.
Problem with the animation in this movie is oh look, we're paying homage to what came before us by saying look, there's Dumbo. He likes peanuts, and it's cute, right? Whatever, Dumbo's really cute.
Yeah.
But then there's no recognition of what you are lifting.
Yeah, and it's also. And it's ignorant. Yeah, exactly. Like the Betty Boop cameo, this never used to bother me, but watching it this time, I hated the Betty Boop cameo because she shows up and the joke is that she's in black and white, so she's out of work and now she's a cigarette girl in a club.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, give me an effing break. Oh, work's been kind of slow since cartoons moved to color. You know, it's like that's a cute line and everything, but according to the internal logic, supposed internal logic of this movie, like, shouldn't that mean there should be like a whole ghetto in Toontown made up of black and white characters who can't work anymore? Which would be amusing if you followed through with it, but that's the point. They don't follow through with it. It's just like a cheap laugh based on ignorance of the history of animation.
Yeah. So. As a segue, we have the fact that Ralph Bakshi isn't ignorant of the history of animation, yet Cool World is still an utter piece of shit.
It really is. And if you thought I had a long-winded introduction to Roger Rabbit, well, you know, strap in, Mama Jama. Ralph Bakshi, I'm a huge fan, and Cool World is a huge piece of shit. However, it's not his fault. And let me explain, because I'm not just saying that because I like the guy. Okay. This is – what I'm about to read is from an interview from DVDVerdict.com from 2004. They asked him, "Were you disappointed by the box office of Cool World and getting into the Hollywood mainstream?" And here's his answer, which explains a lot of why it's such a piece of shit. "Well, Cool World blew me out of the business, if you want an honest answer. When I went to Paramount, I wanted to do the first animated horror film. I hadn't done a film in a long time, and basically the original script I handed in was a cartoonist, live action, who goes to bed with a cartoon girl, and they create a girl, a bastardized child, half live and half real. Paramount bought that script, and when I was on location, they gave me a new script. Frank Mancuso Jr., who was the head of Paramount at the time, had the script rewritten in secret. I had a huge fight with the guy and punched Mancuso Jr. in the mouth." All right, Ralph Bakshi. But Mancuso's father ran Paramount Pictures. He was Frank Mancuso Sr., so I had nowhere to go. Then Kim Basinger, who I never wanted in the picture. I wanted Drew Barrymore and Brad Pitt at that point. Kim wanted a PG film to show in hospitals so she could get a good reputation. She told Alec Baldwin that on set, and I told her she was out of her fucking mind. It was a total disaster. And on top of that, I remember from another interview that Bakshi was under contract not to divulge any of this. He couldn't – like at the time that the movie was coming out, he couldn't tell anybody that he was being forced to do
right.
A script that wasn't his script. So he actually had to keep mum on this for years and like take the heat for this, which must have been awful. The point is this is not the movie he wanted to make. So, you know, that said, like I mentioned earlier, if you go back, it's not in Fritz the Cat, but if you look at the next few movies that Bakshi did in the 70s, like Heavy Traffic and Coonskin, which are great movies, those movies actually have very thoughtful and artistic integrations of live action and animation, like live action backgrounds with animated characters. There's even a few scenes of live actors with cartoons interacting and stuff. And not only that, but a couple of years ago, there was a really great book that was put out about Ralph Bakshi's career called Unfiltered, which tells this secret story behind this movie he did called Hey Good Lookin', which came out in 82. And it's kind of like it's set in the 1950s. It's about greasers. You know, that's the abbreviated just kind of summary of what it was about. But get this. Originally, the movie was released fully animated, but there is a cut of the movie that exists somewhere, like in a Warner Brothers vault, of the movie the way it was intended to be, which was that the four main characters were animated and the rest of the movie was completely live action. And this movie was actually like ready to go in the mid to late 70s. And Warner Brothers freaked out and they were like, we can't release a movie where cartoon characters are the main characters and the rest of the movie is live action. Nobody's going to go to see that. Nobody's going to believe it. So Warner Brothers actually could have jumped the gun on Roger Rabbit by about 10 years. And not only that, it would have been a movie for adults with sex and swearing and all of that stuff. So this is what I mean by these two movies are even more intertwined than meets the eye. So you got to figure, you know, Ralph Bakshi, like by the time Roger Rabbit comes out and he's just done this, you know, Mighty Mouse cartoon that's like spawned Ren and Stimpy, you know, because of the people who worked on it, you know, he's like really excited to do this movie, right? And then he shows up on set and it's like, oh, here's a script by the guys who wrote Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2, The Other Side. And, you know, like how fucking typical Hollywood is it for them to be – for Mancuso Jr. and his screenwriters to be like, yeah, Ralph, you know, your idea of a cartoonist going into a cartoon world and having sex with a cartoon woman, that's all really great, you know. But you know what the story really needs? A cop. Like a hard-nosed cop detective. Like,
so the cop wasn't in Bakshi's original?
No. And what I'm guessing is Bakshi wanted Brad Pitt to be...
Yeah, I read that they wanted Brad Pitt as the cartoonist, which...
Well, look, it would have been more believable than Gabriel Byrne.
Well, true, but I mean, that's like the problem with the movie is that yes, Kim Basinger is unbelievably terrible, but Gabriel Byrne's really bad too, and
Gabriel Byrne
has the excuse at least that the script is terrible when it comes to his character. But
I was so stunned watching the movie, like it never occurred to me. Gabriel Byrne has got to be like the least written ostensible protagonist of any movie ever. The guy just does not have a personality, and he does nothing. He impacts no one. He is a pure cipher.
There's no reason for him to be
in the movie.
That's like the problem is that he's the main character too. When you saw the previews to Cool World, it was about Gabriel Byrne going into Cool World.
He has top billing, and yet, but even when the movie came out, Brad Pitt was the one on the poster. Gabriel Byrne's character just practically doesn't exist. This is a horrendous movie, and it's kind of hard to know where to start. But, Jesus.
The music's good.
who doesn't like My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult? But the fact that Gabriel Byrne's character barely exists is just kind of a feature of the problem. Of the bigger problem that the script is right now, like if anyone asked me off the top of my head, the script to Cool World is my least favorite screenplay ever written in the English language in the history of motion pictures, because it pretends that it has an internal logic. But it really doesn't care about having an internal logic, and it doesn't even hold a consistent internal logic before the movie's prologue is over. I mean, it's going to sound so idiotic recapping anything that happens in this movie, but okay, in the prologue, Brad Pitt is in the 40s. And he has a motorcycle accident and his mom dies. And just as that happens, in the Cool World, a mad scientist creates a device that zaps him into the cartoon world. And the second thing that the mad scientist says to Brad Pitt is that he's sorry about his mother.
Well, he was watching it. He was watching.
No! He didn't open up the portal until after she was dead.
It was a little portal.
But then the very next scene after the prologue is Gabriel Byrne going into the cartoon world. And the way that happens, and this is something that just happens throughout the movie, is that there's a cartoon girl who wants to have sex with a human because that's the only way that she can – the script doesn't even make it clear if that's the only way that she can enter the real world or if that's –
Right. We don't find – that's the surprise. We find that out later.
Okay. That's how she's going to become real. She has to sleep with the guy. So she grabs Gabriel Byrne and pulls him into the cartoon world. Okay, so some cartoon characters can just grab people out of the real world whenever they want to. Oh, no, I guess it was because he's a cartoonist and he's like having some, you know, he's like drawing this world and he's having visions of it. So he's like, you know, mentally connected to it in some way. And then when Brad Pitt, who is now a cop in the Cool World, because, you know, if you had just come back from the war and your mom had just died, you know, and you had just been zapped into a cartoon world, you know, you didn't have anything else going on for you back in the real world. You'd become a cop, right? That's what you would do, right? You got to make a living in this cartoon world.
He's the only one who can because he's human, right?
But he has a cartoon cop partner. And also, why does this lawless, chaotic fantasy world need a police force? Oh, it needs a police force to keep cartoon characters and humans from having sex with each other.
Because it's actually very easy for humans to come through, and we just didn't see the last million that came through. which is the other implication that keeps coming up.
And if it's so dangerous for cartoon characters and humans to mix, of course the mad scientist who knows that would keep the human in the cartoon world. He would just keep him there, where apparently he can live forever because he got taken there from the 40s and now it's the 90s and he's still the same age. So, you know, why not just keep the human around forever, you know, thereby creating an indefinite risk that he might have sex with a car. In fact, he even has a cartoon character girlfriend who he can't have sex with.
So besides all the idiocy of it, we're sort of leaving out.
Besides, that's all there is.
No, there's Kim Basinger's performance. It is truly. Okay, so the animation in Cool World, some of it's pretty good. Some of it's way too cheap. I mean, it obviously it costs $30 million, and it's a shock that it costs $30 million. Like the producer Frank Mancuso Jr. took half of it for himself, and then Kim Basinger took half of that. So they must have had like $7.5 million. I'd believe that. They have these terrible sets for the real people. When the real people are in the animated world, they're on a set, but the animated people are it's animated.
Yeah.
So that's like really, and it's everything's two-dimensional, which I assume was like a stylistic choice, and but it's a bad one. But so the Kim Basinger cartoon has more range of facial expression than Kim Basinger does when she shows up real.
Well put. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's like, what I was realizing. I'm like, wait, she's so much worse right now. Oh, and she has like she brings in her southern accent for when she's real, when she didn't have it before.
Yeah.
And
I know, which makes it seem even less which makes it even harder to believe that it's the same character. But you know, when she's doing the scene like the second shot of her being live action because she just had sex with Gabriel Byrne, when she's doing that scene where she's looking at herself in the mirror as a flesh and blood human for the first time and like reaching out to touch the mirror and she's quivering.
Mm-hmm.
I think I hated her more than I've ever hated her in Batman.
Oh, yeah.
A lot oh, more. Yeah. It's just the most douche chill inducing, cringeworthy, like, and I'm going to give Roger Ebert a second mention in this episode because I read his review for Cool World also. He actually has a good point in his review for Cool World because it's kind of hard not to bash this movie well. But his observation was, in the scene where Gabriel Byrne takes her into a Vegas club and they're both – and she's like in a real human place for the first time, there are like a million things that could happen there and none of them happen.
Well, no, that's the other thing is that the movie's not about a cartoon that becomes a real person. It's about this, a couple stupid things. And then immediately after they get into the real world, like in this scene that we're talking about now, Gabriel Byrne ends up out on the street and then he starts turning into cartoon and oh no, something's going to happen. Like this is bad. And it's still not explained why.
It's not. I mean,
there's this spire thing that they have
okay,
to touch.
Okay. Hold on. Okay. I mean, yeah, Gabriel Byrne and Kim Basinger, they start like, you know, flickering between human and cartoon forms when they're in the real world. And it's like, okay, there does need to be some kind of bad thing that's happening after they have sex, because after all this friggin' buildup, there has to be a reason why it's not a good thing for cartoon characters to be fucking humans and then turning human. But then they bring up the spike kind of out of nowhere. Almost out of nowhere. I mean, you see it at the beginning of the movie because it's what the scientist uses to bring Brad Pitt in, but it hasn't been mentioned since then. And then all of a sudden, like Brad Pitt is talking about it and Kim Basinger is talking about it. And now suddenly it's like the MacGuffin of the movie.
But it also makes no sense because when they reintroduce the cute little scientist guy, he talks about how he couldn't touch it and he tried, he couldn't hold on to it, which means that how would he have put it there? It's just
He used it to go to Vegas and live there, you know, in secret as a cartoon character. And it's like – and, you know, of course there's no real definition as to what this spike can do. So, you know, obviously, of course, Kim Basinger thinks that by just how, like, getting it somehow, that's going to solve her problem of flickering between human and cartoon states. But then when she does get it, which, you know, Ghostbusters style makes cartoons run rampant throughout Vegas, just like ghosts ran rampant through New York at the end of Ghostbusters – it turns her back into a cartoon and she's not even she's not even upset about that. And then Gabriel Byrne is turned into a cartoon who then tries to stop her, but when he's trying to stop her, she goes like, "Oh, you know, I'm not leaving. I like it here."
Right. So apparently cartoons were going to take over the planet Earth, which
apparently that's what Holly — I just called her by her character name.
Yes,
I'm sorry. Apparently that's what Kim Basinger wanted.
But the problem I had with that was we don't know how big Cool World was. So, like, why would you need freaking
– well, you know something? If Bakshi had just gotten to make a movie about a half-breed cartoon human coming back to the real world to kill her father, it wouldn't have mattered.
That's a good point.
It wouldn't
Frank
have mattered.
But Frank Mancuso Jr. –
That's what I hate about this screenplay is that, like, the idea – Bakshi's – the core of Bakshi's story, you know, have sex with a cartoon girl, create an abomination. The abomination comes back to kill you, and that's a horror movie. It's not about the friggin' technicalities of what if humans and cartoons could coexist. And the script from the Poltergeist guys – is all about that and just like zero curiosity about like philosophically what would any of this mean. It just becomes about all this like screenwriting 101 stuff about, you know, what's the bad thing that's going to happen? How's it going to be prevented? And there's a fucking cop whose job it is to keep cartoons and humans from having sex with each other. And the thing I hated the most about that was that once Gabriel Byrne starts coming to the Cool World and bumping in to Brad Pitt, Brad Pitt is telling him, "Don't have sex with cartoon Kim Basinger." And he does this like three times before it happens. And it's like, okay, well, how exactly was he going to prevent him from doing that? And he's saying to him, like, there's some stupid line like, you know, "Keep your pencil in your pocket or I'm going to have to something," you know.
See, I think this movie –
and it's like, what the fuck was he threatening him with?
I think this movie is why Brad Pitt was such a bad actor for so long, because he didn't have to act – he didn't act opposite anyone. He just did a little stand-up. You know, he did like his dramatic stand-up, and it's like you watch it and you're like, well, that's how he was until, you know, Soderbergh or somebody got a hold of him or Terry Gilliam got a hold of him and focused it a little. But I mean, like, Cool World, the problem is it's not what Bakshi wanted to do. And the most interesting thing in the movie then is the story of this guy who's stuck living in the Cool World and he's got a girlfriend that he can't do anything. And so it should be a cop movie, but it's not. Because, I mean, it would have been an amusing cop movie. I mean, Brad Pitt wasn't very good.
Right, that's the thing. Like, maybe it would have been okay if it was just about Brad Pitt, the human cop in cartoon Cool World. But then, like, it's still got all the remnants of Bakshi's idea. And the remnants are so like bare and pitiful that Gabriel Byrne just literally has like no personality whatsoever.
Yeah, the Gabriel Byrne performance is incredibly bad.
I can't even blame him. Like, what the fuck can you do? Your character doesn't even exist. Oh boy. I mean, it opens with him in prison because he killed his wife's lover. And it's like, do you believe for a second that Gabriel Byrne was in prison for murder?
No, well, I did like how he gave all the inmates high fives on his way out and like, told them to stay cool. Because Gabriel Byrne, you know, he strikes me as somebody who'd have an easy time in prison.
Because he didn't, get raped on a daily
basis. No, not at all. Yeah.
And it's like, boy, you talk about Bob Hoskins not being believably tough. What does that make Gabriel Byrne in this movie?
But then he gets back home and he's got a house waiting for him. You know, it's the only movie where the guy gets out of prison.
And his neighbor across the street has a crush on him because, you know, someone's going to have to drive him and Brad Pitt around in a car during the final act.
Right,
because,
you know, that's like a real – it's like – I was actually surprised to learn that these two guys didn't go on to write Dude, Where's My Car? Like, a big dramatic moment of the movie, it really is, how are we going to get there? We need a car. But Holly's got my car. What'll we do? And, like, the teenage girl's like, I'll take you. My mom will be okay since we're saving the world.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the problem is that Bakshi's direction of the human stuff, the real stuff, is just awful. It's just awful.
Well, I mean, he fucking hated every second of it.
I understand that, but I mean, it's just...
I mean, that's kind of the interesting... I think, I mean, because the other thing I remember that he said about this movie in interviews is that, like, well, I had to make a script that wasn't mine, but at least I had free rein on the animation.
Right.
And it sort of is there, but even that isn't completely purely him, because this dude directed Fritz the Cat, and this movie is – okay, so let's – we got to – this is what I'm segueing to here, because this is the other big problem of the movie besides the convoluted, made-up-as-it-goes-along script. It's supposed to be an adult Roger Rabbit that isn't even for like 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
Not just in terms of – you know, the maturity of the story or the characters or whatever, but just the fact that the whole movie hinges on cartoon sex, and they can't even show cartoon boobs. And it's like, how commonplace are cartoon boobs now, like with anime and everything? It's like yesterday's news by now, but in 1992, like, you know, Ren and Stimpy had just come out, like The Simpsons, you know, like people really wanted to kind of see like an animated movie for adults. And that's what this movie is promising. It's promising to be Roger Rabbit for adults. But
it's promising to be a movie that a 15-year-old would have to sneak into. And instead it's...
instead, they can't... they have to call it Doing It. This movie has more references to like, did you do it? Did you do it with her? Don't do it with her.
On the other hand, I did like that Nails, who's like the best part of the movie, is Brad Pitt's sidekick.
Yeah, the cartoon sidekick of Brad Pitt. Yeah.
He keeps telling Brad Pitt these like sex stories, but the dialogue is very confusing because it's like,
I'm guessing the dialogue is also the product of the screenwriter.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very confusing, but it almost at one or two points implies that Nails the spider has sex with human women or something.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
The first story he tells, he talks about like he's telling him a sex story, and it seemed to me like he was intimating that he'd broken the rules or something, and that Brad Pitt should break.
I didn't catch that.
That Brad Pitt should break the rules with his girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, you know, I want to say something nice. Okay. I want to say some nice things about the animation in this movie. You know, Holly's a bitch and everything, but Brad Pitt's cartoon girlfriend in this movie is actually a lot sexier than Jessica Rabbit ever was, because she actually has proportions that resemble human proportions, and then on top of that, she's kind of like Lois Lane in the old Fleischer Superman cartoons or something like that. That kind of design,
right? I would really actually like, because Brad Pitt eventually becomes a cartoon, so they can have sex, but they don't show it. They just like Oh no, we can really do it now. Is actually
we got to keep the PG-13. You know.
Well, no, it was intended for a PG, and then it got slapped with a PG-13, and they didn't fight it. Yeah, because this is the most appropriate thing for a PG movie. Yeah, and then Brad Pitt turns into a cartoon, and he's this terribly animated cartoon. Like, I can't figure out why they drew him. He looks like Little Abner, right? Like,
yeah. Well, that's. Yeah, he does, yeah.
Yeah, and so I just feel like it'd be fun to get a still of that and go up to Brad Pitt all the time.
Ask him to sign.
And be like, hey, can you sign this for me, Mr. Pitt?
Yeah, you did. Your voice work was just...
It was stunning. You know, really ambush him good. Ambush him when he's
those
like...
For those 2 seconds at the end of the movie, man, you know, you haven't done cartoon performing that good, and you didn't do cartoon acting that good until Inglourious Basterds, you know? Yeah, and also the thing about the animation and the design of this movie is that I think if Bakshi had gotten to make the movie that he wanted, Cool World would have looked the same. Yeah, actually, it would have. It would have been like a dark, dystopic, sinister-looking city that's populated by, you know, a few sexy, you know, human-proportioned women, but then the vast majority of the characters running around are like 1930s Fleischer, Betty Boop, Popeye-style things. And I really like that contrast, and it's really, like, compelling. But man, oh man, that is asking too much of general audiences to like appreciate that.
Yeah.
Because any audiences at the time, I mean, people thought this movie was like a, you know, crappily animated, cheap piece of shit. And I mean, I even did too at the time because I thought like, well, the characters don't move as much as they did in Roger Rabbit. But the design of the dark city with the grotesquely cartoony things, that's compelling because it's kind of in Roger Rabbit, the scene where Bob Hoskins goes to Toontown, it's sort of implied that he's like in physical danger by being there. I mean, like he falls out of a building, you know, and then it seems like he's going to die. And there's almost the question of like, is a human being in Toontown in real mortal danger? But apparently not, because, well, Roger Rabbit, you know, a toon killing a human is, you know, it's like this big crime, even though apparently it's not the first time it's happened, because it happened to Bob Hoskins' brother. But I mean, those are kind of the interesting, you know, existential, weird, really out there ideas that were kind of, you know, just incidental in Roger Rabbit. And then in Cool World, like, I think if Bakshi had gotten to make the movie he wanted to make, those questions would have been at the forefront. They're not at the forefront in the Cool World that exists, but they're on the periphery still. Or at least they're part of, like, the feel of the movie. And I don't know. That's kind of why I enjoy it. And this is going to sound weird after all of that, but I think I kind of enjoy watching Cool World more at this point because I just like the ugly. Because I just like the ugly weirdness of it. I like how ugly and weird it is, even if Bakshi can't go all out and have real, you know, sex or violence or language. I fucking love the scene where Nails the Spider is waiting for the phone to reach Brad Pitt at the club, and he's like chewing on the desk. And then he's nervous. And then afterwards, when he's like nervously loading the bullets into the gun,
that is a good.
That is such good care. That's better character animation than anything that's in Roger Rabbit. Actually,
yeah, but I think to be fair to Roger Rabbit, there's no opportunity for that because it's not a movie about cartoons. It's a movie about Bob Hoskins and his.
Yeah, and then Cool World. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
and Cool World takes the time. Yeah, you can see the difference in the two.
To be more of a cartoon, a movie about cartoon characters.
Yeah, Nails was great. He almost makes the movie worthwhile.
He almost saves it. Yeah, sure. Well, yeah. So, yeah, I don't. If I didn't, yeah. So I don't know. I mean, this movie did terribly, obviously. And it really killed the idea. It really, I mean, this and Space Jam killed the live action animation hybrid movie for different reasons. But, I don't know. I think I enjoy Cool World more now than before, but at the same time, I hate it more than ever too, because, I used to see this movie on TV, right? And I would never see it all at once. I would see parts of it. and I would always assume that the reason I didn't completely know what was going on was because I was watching it in pieces on TV. This was the first time I ever watched it from start to finish. And now I think I hate the screenplay for this movie more than anything, more than any other screenplay I could name right now.
Yeah, it's, and you know what the thing is what's called good. I mean, what am I trying to say? Poltergeist 1's a good movie.
Yeah,
like
sure.
It's you know, it's a very not, popular like, whatever.
You know, that was because of the writing, was it?
Well, yeah, but the writing wasn't god-awful. I mean, the writing in this is god-awful.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen Poltergeist 2, so.
Yeah, neither have I. I looked up Poltergeist, and I think that Spielberg did one of his uncredited rewrites on Poltergeist.
He actually has a third credit.
Oh, does he?
The first one, yeah. So who knows to the what extent he...
He probably brought John Sayles in to write it or something, but took credit for it. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I can... there's like 6 good minutes of Cool World, and it's like...
Yeah.
The nails scene probably takes the nails and the telephone. The telephone scene's actually funny too, because the telephone, the whole concept, ringing telephone hurts the telephone, and so
know,
he needs to get it taken care of right away. That's very funny. That's the longest good scene, and it's probably about 45 seconds. So, and it's actually like the best scene in the movie, because you care about Nails, and he's about to get hurt. And you know it's coming. But then the other good stuff is, yeah, it's like there's actually this really good shot of Brad Pitt's girlfriend walking. And it's a really good shot because it's like it's they're animating a real set, or they've got a physical set where they add the animated character to, but they're not drawing attention to the two-dimensional scenery. Mm-hmm. It's just a really kind of cool shot. You could have done the exact same shot animated and it'd still be really cool, but it's just a really nice little moment. And then Mark Isham's score is actually, it's really good.
You're right. It's easy to overlook.
Yeah.
But
when you're suffering at some point,
considering
it's really good. Yeah.
Considering the probably insurmountable task of coming up with a music score for this piece of shit, he does a really good job.
Yeah.
And then when I think of the music in this movie, all I can think about is all the techno music that they
I thought it had a different tie-in song.
The David Bowie song at the end of the movie during the credits that's called Real Cool World is pretty good.
Yeah, but
it doesn't sound like the rest of the soundtrack, which is all my Life with the Thrill Kill Cult kind of techno.
I thought it was that Matthew Sweet song.
No, he's not on the soundtrack.
No, he's not at all, but I'm looking up his Wikipedia, and yes, he had
he had
an animated cartoon from Space Adventure Cobra.
Oh yeah, he used to put anime clips in his music videos.
I sort of thought that this was it. Oh wow, he turned into Meatloaf too. That's interesting.
Ooh, he used to be such a sweet boy. Yeah, he used to put anime clips in his music videos.
So I just sort of associate cartoons with this, but yeah.
All right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Matthew Sweet should have been Gabriel Byrne in this. Oh, one little bit of trivia that I'd like to point out, and I sort of they even put this in the trailer, which is probably why I remember it so well, because I saw the trailer. I didn't see this movie when I was a kid, but I remember the trailer well. Anyways, the point is, when Gabriel Byrne is about to have sex with cartoon Kim Basinger, they cut to various cartoon characters around Cool World somehow all sensing that something's up and that forbidden law is about to be broken. And then they cut to these Disney-style cartoon rabbits, and the rabbit mom looks at the camera and says, "Man is in the bedroom," which, if you've seen Bambi, is a really funny reference. It's a reference to the scene in Bambi where the hunter is about to shoot Bambi's mom, and one of the animals goes, "Man is in the forest," and it's too informed a reference to be in the movie.
Yeah, just a little.
It's too clever for the movie, really, for such a rock stupid movie. Okay. Well, let's see. Anything else about the Cool World? Anything else? Okay. Well, one last stupid thing about the script that I'll point out is you mentioned how Brad Pitt becomes a cartoon character at the end. The reason he becomes a cartoon character at the end is because in real world Vegas, he's killed by cartoon Kim Basinger. And then when his human body is brought back to cartoon world and Nails and the cartoon girlfriend are mourning him, the cartoon girlfriend suddenly realizes and points out that because he was killed by a cartoon character, he now is going to become a living cartoon. And it's like, well, isn't that convenient? Isn't that a convenient happy ending? And it's a good thing too, because Gabriel Byrne was such a cipher that we just let him become a cartoon character and forgot about him.
Yeah, it's
like you said, Brad Pitt just should have been the main character. There shouldn't have been Gabriel Byrne in this movie.
I'm frightened, but I wonder if there's a longer version.
Oh, I'm going to guess no, just because animation is too expensive for that.
No, I'm thinking just with all the human stuff, like building up Gabriel Byrne's relationship with the neighbor girl, because you don't even find out her name. You don't even know that he knows her.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think there was probably more live action stuff that got cut out.
Paramount, they made such fine films in the early 90s.
Yeah, why couldn't they have just kept making Friday the 13th sequels?
Produced by Frank Mancuso Jr.
Yeah, he was all right when he was doing those. But as soon as he tried anything else, Yeah, I would only recommend Cool World if you're a huge cartoon nerd. If you're just like a regular movie fan who doesn't particularly care for cartoons, watch Roger Rabbit.
That's good advice.
Because there's some beautiful animation in Cool World, but Jesus, I mean, you might as well keep the sound off the whole time. And put on your favorite My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult album. Sex on Wheels. By the way, how funny is it that, like, because they had to keep this PG-13, that, like, the sex scene with Holly is just like she's dry humping him. It's like worse than a Showtime softcore porn, because at least on Showtime or Skinamax you'd have nudity along with the simulated sex.
Yeah, it's like a music video simulated sex scene.
Yeah,
not even an artful one. Yeah.
Oh boy. Or, you know, watch a real Ralph Bakshi movie from the 70s, then you'll get actual cartoon sex. Not between cartoons and humans, unfortunately, but, you know. Okay, well, I guess that about does it. So, our next episode is going to be about more non-humans interacting with humans, isn't it? It's going to be our Muppet episode. It's the classic The Muppet Movie and the last Muppet movie they made before the new one, Muppets from Space. And I'm excited to be doing this one with you because I know you're a big Muppets fan. You're such a big Muppets fan that even on your comics blog, The Comics Fondle, you review the Muppets comics.
That's because those are good for the most part.
Yeah, okay. So I think you really – you'll next episode you can do all the talking about the medium of the Muppets.
I'd have to read on it, yeah.
Well, I think – I think you probably know more about it than I do, just like I had to go on and on about the history of animation in this episode. But anyways, yeah, that'll be great. So next episode is the Muppets episode. And for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.
And make sure to visit the AlanSmithyPodcast.com.
That's all, folks.
You had plenty money, 1922. You do right like some other men do. Get out of here.
She's married to Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, what a lucky girl.
Prepared 20 years ago, you wouldn't be wandering now from door to door. Why don't you do right like some other man do? Get out. Get out.